Welcome, everyone. Tragedies and trauma can shake us to our core. Often we're left wondering how we can pick up the pieces and move on from what has happened. My guest today, Dr. Louise Stanger, has turned her life around. She's had a lot of loss and challenges, and now she has a life of perseverance and accomplishment. Dr. Louise is a prominent addiction interventionist who has overcome more than her fair share of troubles. Not only did she lose her dad and grandparents to suicide, but her husband died before she turned 45, and she had an infant son that died of SIDS. Dr. Louise's experiences have greatly influenced her work, and she helps others learn how to overcome addiction, helps families rebound from the damage that comes from addiction, and she's here to share her inspirational story and strategies that we can use to rebuild after tragedy and trauma. Dr. Louise, welcome to the show. So honored to have you on, and thank you for sharing your story with us.
Oh, Erica, thank you so much. It is such a privilege to be with you. You're just such a bright light for our community. I'm so inspired by what you do.
Oh, thank you. I'm so grateful to hear that. Thank you very much. And I'm inspired by you. And you're really someone that I've always looked up to. And you have so much incredible experience that you've pulled from your own life. I feel like we all, you know, I think for a lot of us, I think everyone's dealt different cards. We've all gone through something. We've all had some experiences that have given us that contrast, you know, dark and light, learning how to have grief and come to joy at some point. And how can we begin to understand that we need those kind of contrasts in life to really see what we're capable of and how to live the best lives that we want to create?
Well, I think that when we take a look at life, in order to live life, you have to be what I call in the arena. You have to be living it. And inevitably, you are going to have things which you can call hiccups, or like Humpty Dumpty, you can have periods in which you fall down. Things happen. A lot of things are totally, at least when we took a look at my life, were out of my control. Certainly the sudden death of my father, my first husband, his parents, my infant son, those were things that I was totally powerless over. But in those experiences, I have choices. And I had a lot of help too. But how do I respond? How do I learn to live life? And what can I do to help others who experience other types of tragedies? But once we're in the arena, we have falling down periods, but we can always fall up.
I love that. I love that. And like you said, you know, we are really powerless over a lot of things that happen to us in life. There's natural disasters, there's deaths, there's accidents, there's a lot of things that go on. And then there's also the things that, like you said, we have choices over, we can control. And that's really what I like to address with clients too, is to empower them to see that, hey, you know, there's going to be some things we can't control, but yet there's so much that you can, not to be fixated on being controlling, but, you know, we are responsible for how we react, how we treat ourselves, how we treat others, how we take care of our bodies, our minds, our spirits, you know. So I think that there's a lot in that too, that we could also focus on and reframe with clients that are in a place of hopelessness. Would you say that that's something you addressed too in the beginning?
Yeah, I definitely do. And so when you think about things that happen that are unexpected tragedies, whether as you suggested, and the reason, by the way, I wrote the book Falling Up was because everybody asked me, how am I going to be able to work with families? And they wanted an academic book, and you know I'm an academic, and I've written a lot of academic journal articles and everything. And I thought, you know what, maybe at this stage in my life, because I am seasoned, meaning I'm a bit older, I'm going to share my life in the hopes that it can also inspire others. And so in those times when we have tragedies befall us, one of the things we look around and say, where's that village there that's going to help us? Are there other people within the realm? And certainly as a young girl, if I just take my father's death, I was really blessed. My mother is what I later coined non-intentionally emotionally unavailable. In the wake of her husband's suicide, she needed to focus on, she was, you know, she had so many things to do that it wasn't that she, I don't believe she didn't love me. She self-soothed, we know, with alcohol, But at the same time, she was called on to do so many things and had her own set of shame that what she did was she reached out, and luckily a relative sent me away to camp because we didn't have the resources to do it. And at that camp was a wonderful social worker, and his name was Leon Rubenstein. And during the summer of that very confusing seven-year-old, I was able to shoot bows and arrows, ride a horse, learn how to make hospital corners on a bed, and literally be taken in by these wonderful social workers. And I continued to be taken into them, but by the time I graduated high school, because they were still in my arena. Did I quite understand the alarm? Was I able to work through totally the grief and loss and confusion that I experienced? It took many years to do that. But what I was able to do, and what I'm able to do with other people, is teach them how to grieve their losses and move on. Because I think in life we have choices, and the choices sort of boil down to, am I going to be a victim? Do I need to be a martyr? Or do I have a choice to live life to its fullest? And those are choices that we help our clients with. And within that, acknowledge these things are terrible what happened. You know, I had an opportunity to work with the widows of 9/11.
Wow.
That was you know, you can't even begin to fathom.
Unimaginable.
I also had the opportunity to interview women who were widowed at a young age across the United States and learn about their trajectories and what they were able to do and how they were able to do it. But the common theme of resilience, of renewal, is somehow or other people were able to not hide what happened to them, not mourn for what happened to them, but actually in an unconscious and then conscious maybe made a choice that life can be good, that I am not a victim, that I don't have to have all the issues that, that my ancestors had, nor do I have to live in dark. There can be light.
Right, absolutely. And when you were talking about grieving and moving on, is for people that are listening out there that really have not dealt with grief or they don't know how to move on, is there something like I know this is such a intense and multi-layered conversation, but is there any tips or tools that you have for the audience?
Well, I think in terms of grieving, one of the things that's always helpful for people is you know, one, not to beat yourself up if you're a parent and you're grieving the loss of maybe a spouse or something. In those moments, the people out there who are your friends, I'd say when someone experiences a death firsthand, it's not in those first moments, it's not in those first weeks that, that you need the help, but it's in the weeks and months to come. So for those of you that have friends or relatives that really care, that's when you reach out. That's when you let people talk to you in the middle of the night. That's when you take them places and you have them do. Because after the flurry of activity, people disappear. Yeah. They scatter like mice. And it's really in those times. It's okay to feel awful. Being awful doesn't mean that it's pathological. There is being depressed after someone dies is normal. You don't necessarily have to be, you know, when you go, there's good research which says the moment you show up in a doctor's office, they're going to give you something. You may not need that medication. It may be okay just to experience it. Death takes you down a really different path roads. It can be one minute you can be okay, the next minute a tidal wave comes over you. There's always what we call trigger moments, memories. And what we teach people to do is do something as a memory to celebrate yourself and celebrate that person. So you hear about people releasing balloons. You hear about, I remember my daughters, one of the ways that they like to memorialize their father is they'll go out for Chinese food. Why? He loved Chinese food.
He loved it.
He also liked black cars. And I swear to you, they all have black cars. doesn't matter the make, but that's a way in which they can compartmentalize, keep alive, and move forward. But there's always ways, so you don't have to have that sort of feeling be with you 24/7. And that's what,
right.
And reach out to a counselor like you. People mm-hmm. need to know, and people need to know that while as beautiful as Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was, people grieve in different ways. So, you know, mm-hmm. denial comes into play as a shock absorber. It's our friend in the beginning because, of, my mm-hmm. God, the enormity of that sudden death, the enormity of what happened. You know,
right.
you're protected. By and by, that needs to give way to being able to grieve. And different
right.
people in the family will grieve in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I'm happy I guess the other thing
that.
Are there are support groups and there are chat mm-hmm. rooms. But not everybody loves to be in a large support group, okay?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so sometimes it's one-on-one, talking to someone else who's had yeah. the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And like you said, there's always things we can do. We could write letters. We can honor those. There's so many ways in which we can honor people. We don't have to do it in a traditional mm-hmm. sense. And if you're somebody that's a little bit, you know, values your solitude, you don't have to do it in such a public way either. I think it's just a matter of really finding somebody to trust, to help guide you, that you could lean on a professional of some kind. And, you know, there's so many resources out there these days that I think by, you know, speaking up and also verbalizing your pain is also important too, because I know there's so many people that just stuff it down and walk on and really it comes up and it won't really dissipate unless it is addressed.
I totally agree with you, Erica. And one other thing, you know, when you're talking about the death of a spouse, not all spouses love their spouses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Or death of a relationship.
Yeah.
So sometimes
yeah.
that's a freedom. And sometimes because
right.
we have these myths mm-hmm. in our society, like no, everybody loves to do the wash, right? Don't you just love doing wash and folding clothes? Everybody should love their spouse, but not everybody loves their spouse or their partner, or sometimes they've had bad times. So it's okay to feel a mm-hmm. sense of relief and not to mm-hmm. feel guilty about that.
Right. And to look at it in a different way. I mean, even if you are sad and if there is a loss, there's still beauty in having the relationship. There's lessons learned within that relationship. And, you know, we all have different beliefs, but I truly believe that there is somehow that the universe is working for us and not against us. So with that belief, at least for me, it lends itself to understand why certain things happen, even if it's uncomfortable, even if it's painful. There is something bigger than just that. So, you know, I think it is important to read books, to read different ways of looking at things. I think it's very powerful to challenge your mindset and learn how to reframe.
I agree. And the other thing that I wanted to put out there, because we're talking about death and loss, a lot of people, and because I did a lot of qualitative research in this area, and a lot of people, when you talk with them, they're going to tell you about things that they feel are extraordinary, like clocks at stopping at 11:11, which is a psalm, like mm-hmm. feeling like they left something there and it moved over there, or lights
yeah.
flickering on and off, signs,
yeah.
Butterflies landing on shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these things are inexplicable and not explained, but mm-hmm. yet all is still real.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've had it happen to me with some of my loved ones. It's
yes. So,
yes.
So acknowledge, I guess, as a professional, I want to affirm people if they're saying, oh, my God, you know, this is what happened, and I'm feeling
yeah.
really like I'm just imagining. But when you talk to so many people and they report some of this stuff, you know, who is to say that there isn't something greater than ourselves?
Right. And thank you for saying that. And everyone's entitled to what they believe in, but I appreciate you saying that and normalizing that for some people out there that may have experienced that. Can you tell me a little bit about what influenced your work in general? I mean, I know you've been through a lot of grief and loss within your life, but what influenced you to also discuss everything that you've discussed in Falling Up? It's a memoir of renewal, I know. What has influenced you the most in terms of it inspired you in your life?
Oh, my gosh. What has inspired me the most? Well, I would invite you to come over to my office that I'm in right now. because I have a vision. You know, I'm a bit older. I'm about to approach my 70th year. And so I decided, again, people were asking me to write a book about how to help families. And I just clunked my head. And I made a great big vision board. And the vision board is totally nonlinear, meaning it doesn't have, like, chronological order. But it's 13 feet wide and 6 feet high. And I think there's a picture of it in my book. And what I did was I took images, because when we think about our lives, it's really a kaleidoscope of images. And they're done in a nonlinear fashion. And that was the inspiration for Falling Up. And I felt like it's interesting because I'm a clinician, so we have the thing, you don't share your story because it's to do no harm. But at this point, I felt it was important for me to own my own story. There's a whole theory of human behavior which talks about narrative, owning your own story. Brené Brown will talk about in Rising Strong, you know, the reckoning. And I felt like if I can teach others how to own, if I can show my story but intersperse it with chapters, they can begin to own their story.
Absolutely.
I think that having grown up in a family beset with alcoholism, with substance abuse, with mental health problems, experiencing all these sudden deaths, I just wanted to say that, you know, as I approach this point in my life, that, you know, life is good. I wake up each morning and I do a grateful list. And I try and be of service to others. And that's the gift. Would I have wanted things a little bit differently? Sure, who wouldn't have? But that's not the trajectory that happened for me. And if I can give that hope, that inspiration, and skills and strategies to others, then isn't that a gift? And what I've learned, Erica, and I'm sure you learned in the clients you deal with, I have a chapter in my book. It's called If You Meet the Buddha on the Road, Kill Him. And it's really my philosophy of teaching, my philosophy of being a counselor, of an interventionist, that the gifts I get from working with people and seeing them grow, transform, and become the man, the woman, the husband, the father, the brother, sister, partner, they're meant to be, or the successful person in the workforce, that, and they far surpass me. They kill the Buddha. That's the greatest gift.
Oh, wow. That's a really powerful analogy, and it is such a powerful gift to help others. And like you said before, I just want to touch upon this quick, is the gratitude. You know, if you can incorporate gratitude in your life in some way, whether it's making a list, or, you know, when I changed my life and stopped drinking, I started running or exercising, and at the end of my exercise, I would in my head go over the things that I was grateful for on the last block of my run. And it was very powerful for me, because I was moving my body. I was tapping into something mentally and emotionally. My heart felt full. And for me, it really set the tone every day. So I think we could all find a way to have a gratitude practice of some kind, even if it's for 2 minutes, even if it's, you know,
that's
when you're
right.
still.
I always challenge my families to do the following. I say, wake up and list 5 things you're grateful for. And they go, okay, well, I woke up. You know, and then I invite families or loved ones, or the identified loved ones, to take a look and do 3 things each week physically, 3 things each week that are help you emotionally, and they don't need to be big things. Think of the alphabet, A to Z. You can fill in the blanks. And 3 things that are spiritual or consistent with your values.
Absolutely.
And if you, that's a total of about 9 plus 5. You know, that's a lot of things. But if you can wake up each morning and find goodness and look for strength, not in a Pollyannish, it can help you restructure. It's cognitive restructuring.
Yes.
And then the other thing is to be of service, which takes us outside of it. And that's why we see with recovering people, so much of it is geared towards, what are you going to do for service? How are you going to serve others? You know, maybe it's only fixing chairs in a meeting, if that's what you do.
Right. And also, like you said, to own your story. You never know when that's going to help somebody. I love a quote that says, like, a teacher's reach has no no end. It's endless. You know, it's like for people that have changed their lives in some way, and they tell someone else what has helped them, or they're the light, or they hold their hand through it, or whatever it is that you do, big or small. It's so powerful, and it really has a ripple effect. And like you said, a ripple effect of goodness is great. A ripple effect of spreading hope, of spreading light, whatever that is. It's, you know, it's powerful when we reach out to another human being and help that person. So I love that you are mentioning that too to our audience today. And I like the vision board. Just quickly, if nobody has tried this yet, how can someone get started?
Well, I know you don't need a 13-foot-long, 6-foot-high. But what you do, you can get a big piece of cardboard. You make an 8x10. And think about, in a perfect world, well, there's two kinds of vision boards. One is, in a perfect world, given if you went to sleep, what would your life look like tomorrow?
Ooh, I like that.
And that might be, you know, if you want to write a book, whatever it is, I want to go to school, and you and you take magazines and you just paste it on.
Okay. So cut out some images. Yeah.
You just do images, and then you just put it there. I do a vision board like that almost every year. And that's just on a big piece of manila paper where I sit there and I say, okay, what did I want to have happen this year? So for me, some of the things I wanted to do work-wise was talk across the country, do a lot of speaking across the country. I also wanted to make sure my book was finished, complete, published, and done. The other thing, and then there were some personal things that I thought were important. I have grandchildren. I want to really honor them, to find some time with them. I want to travel, but I also want to be of service. So, I mean, my vision board is going to be a little different than your vision board. If we're talking about owning our story, I think it's Anne DeMont. She calls it SFD. I hope I can say this. We write our stories, and it's shitty first draft. We write stories, and the first stories we write may not exactly be the best. But what I would tell you, if you want to begin to write your own story, I can share with you what I got up at 5 in the morning because I work. I have this wonderful big standing desk, which sort of changed my vision. I only still type with about 6 fingers because I wrote my dissertation on a legal notebook pad. I was not born in the electronic age. But I would get up and I would write, and I wouldn't, I write sort of what my heart was telling me. And again, my book is written in nonlinear fashion, which means you can pick up any chapter you want. Because I think we think in images. We think of what's important to us. We remember events that are important to us. And so I wrote about them. And I wrote enough, and I did work with a young editor who I would send stuff off to, and I loved him because he's a 27-year-old graduate of the University of Texas. He didn't grow up in an alcoholic family. He's just a good, you know, he was a great writer, and he had that third eye objectivity. And I would send it off to him. He would take a look at it and say, well, I like this, and we would work, and he would send back like grammatical things, or he'd put it in sort of form. And so together we did a dance.
That's fantastic. That's so fantastic. I'm really grateful that you're sharing your own experience with all this, because there's so many people out there that are creative that can share their stories too. And it's just, no one knows how to get there. So thank you for, you know, giving our audience that kind of information. And please tell everybody where they can find you.
So if you're interested in getting Falling Up, you just need to go to Amazon.com. Mm-hmm. It's called Falling Up, A Memoir of Renewal by Sanger. It's all of $14.99. and I'd love to hear what you think. Or you can go visit me on my website, www.allaboutinterventions.com, or give me a call, 619-507-1699.
Thank you, Dr. Louise. You are a warrior and a blessing to us all and a beautiful spirit. Thank you so much for being with us. You're listening to Rewired Radio on Radio MD. I'm Erica Spiegelman. Thank you for joining us, and stay well.